You see what I'm getting at here? If they were always enabled with a normal operation of the ignition switch being off, it wouldn't be fair to us to be able to go in there and change a fuse from the interior of the car.
I have a little bit more here.
Yeah, from everything I'm hearing, I think it's an enable function. If you were replacing the airbag, and if it had a thoroughly independent accelerometer connected to it, which fires it when you exceed a certain acceleration, and if you made the mistake of dropping that airbag assembly, it would deploy. So I think it requires at least an enable function, maybe not an external power. Sounds like Lou has some further comments. Go ahead, Lou, K2IW.
So this is a website called Qura, Q-U-R-A. And someone asked the question directly. And the answer is no, the airbag will not deploy if the car is parked with the ignition off, even if the key is in the ignition but turned off. If the key is in the ignition and turned on, even if the engine is not running, the airbags will be active. If you are idling at a stoplight, your airbags will be active. When you first turn the ignition off, there may be enough power in the airbag circuit to activate the airbags for a few minutes to an hour or so, depending on the airbag system in place. This is why mechanics disconnect the power to the system and wait an hour or so before working on the steering wheel. Airbags won't deploy in many cars if you don't have someone in the passenger seat, or a lightweight or a small child in the passenger seat. There is no one to protect and no reason to deploy the airbag, or deploying the airbag with a small child in the seat could cause more injuries than it would save. The newer your car is, the more likely this is to be the case. So the answer to your question is yes, an airbag of a parked car can deploy, but only if the key is in the ignition and turned on. It says the engine is idling or is within a few minutes of when the car was last turned off. But that last paragraph kind of isn't what they said at the beginning. The engine doesn't have to be idling. It just has to be in the on position, the key. So there you go.
The fact that, John recognized, the fact that the airbag, some number of minutes after turning off the ignition, can still be deployable, suggests that the automobile supplies an enable function.
Thinking more about this, listening to all the great comments, hope I'm not misleading anyone. For one, remember I'm talking about a 90s car. I think if you look it up, you'll probably find some clear dates when things change. You know, the technology of our airbags in the 90s were probably pretty primitive to what's going on now. Also, it occurred to me that when all the comments were coming and nobody said it, that if you don't have your seatbelt on these days, I believe the airbag will not deploy you. There's some kind of interlock there. I kind of remember reading or hearing that at one time as well. So I thought there's been a lot of changes and things, especially from the National Institute of Automotive Safety, whatever that's called. It'd be interesting to see what the sort of lineage is of how these things work. I'm curious now, I may look it up later. Let me give a little time in front of the computer. K2IW, thanks for all, and everyone else, thanks for all the great comments. KC2, SHO.
John, if I was foolish enough to drive an automobile without connecting my seatbelt, I have a much greater need for that airbag. To disable the airbag because my seatbelt is not connected seems crazy. Now, in the case of the passenger seat, seatbelt not being used, that's one of the indications that there is no human being there, therefore don't deploy that one. But the main driver to disable the airbag because I'm not using a seatbelt, that seems opposite of common sense. What do you think, John?
Well, when it comes to things like this, I don't know that my common sense matters. It matters what happens in the crash test, but you may be right. I can tell you something about the passenger seat. And you know, now that I think about it, I don't see this on my driver's side. In my 2008 Tundra, if I put my if I put a heavy bag on the passenger seat and just drive around, I get no indication. But if I put the seatbelt over it and click it in to keep the bag secure, then it warns me that the airbag is not enabled because the weight is not high enough. So there's another clue. K2IWKC2SHO, it's a rabbit hole, I think.
WS2N.
All recognized. I have a friend who intentionally does not wear a seatbelt because he has a fear that if he's in an accident and the car is burning, he won't be able to relieve the car. And he did have an accident, and without his seatbelt, his body shifted forward, his knees jammed into the instrument panel, his legs were injured, his chest was injured by the steering wheel. He still believes he's doing the right thing. Every accident consists of at least two accidents. The first accident, your vehicle is striking some kind of a solid, non-moving object, and your vehicle is rapidly decelerating, slowing down. You inside the vehicle are still moving forward at full velocity, and you're going to hit the inside surfaces of the automobile. So the second accident is the one that does the damage, when you hit the various objects. So for you not to be tied down is crazy. Okay, yeah. Who is it that want to make some further comment? Go right ahead, K2LIW. Yeah, Paul first, and then BZ second. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
When you read these car manuals, you know, they tell you push your seat back as far as possible, no matter how tall you are. Make sure it's back as far as possible to get away from the steering wheels as far back as you can. No, because when the airbag goes off, you know, it'll take your head off if you're too close. So my guess is if you don't have that seatbelt on, they know that that seatbelt is going to restrain you to some degree where you're not going to go that far forward. Your head might not get that close to the wheel. If it's disconnected, you're going to go right up to the wheel, and here's, you know, at the same time, this thing's going to be floating in a microsecond. That's how long it takes it. Opens and closes that fast. They say after they go off, you don't even know what happened. Some people look around and I wonder if my airbag went off. You know, it's that fast. You know, that's my guess on why they have that rule.
KD2FIU.
W2BZ and George in that order. BZ first, go ahead.
I had an accident where a woman pulled out in a huge Cadillac Escalade without even looking. And I was going a good 40 miles an hour, and I rammed into the back of her. And the next thing I knew, I was saying to myself, boy, what an, I heard an explosion, and then the next thing I knew, I was laying across, and I had my seatbelt on, I was laying across the front passenger seat, and I said, how odd a smell that is. I've never smelled, you know, an odor like that. It was the airbag that went off. But it probably, I don't know, probably saved me a tremendous injury. And nothing, I didn't have any injury at all. But that explosion is loud.
How did you end up across the passenger seat? What pushed you off to one side? Go ahead.
No, I lost consciousness for probably just a couple of seconds because nobody had, it was in front of a school. And nobody had come out yet. There were 30 people who ran out, the nurse and blah, 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 from the school, but there was nobody out. So I lost consciousness for, I would say, about 3 or 4 seconds. So I don't know how, that's how I came to, lying across my head was on the passenger seat.
In that particular incident, how much damage was there to the Cadillac and to your vehicle? Did the two of them collide at like 30 miles an hour?
She was going about 40 miles an hour, and she was just pulling out of a parking spot and accelerating. I caught the corner of her car, And so I was going 40, she was going whatever, 5. And there was very little damage on her car, and my car was totaled with the grill went right through the battery, and the hood of the car was almost...
No fun. George, go ahead. What experience have you had with airbags?
Okay, Dick, I'll be quick and I'll drop this from my end over here. About 10 years ago, I was reading an article in the New York Times Tuesday Science Edition about safety factors in automobiles. And until that point in time, probably 2009, 2010, when I read this article, the single most effective factor was the first one that was put in place in the early 60s, and that is the waist belt. That accounts for more than 65 to 70% of our safety around our hips, the waist belt. Prior to that, we were all over the car, all over the interior, all over the road. And then in 68, the shoulder belt became an installation in automobiles. And then finally, through the 80s and the 90s, until today, the advancements of very, very sophisticated airbags came in to give us a lot more. But 65 to 70% is, and I'm not saying this was the article I read, is of the waist.
Right.
And the more modern seatbelts also include a chest harness. So except for our heads, we're pretty nicely held down to that seat. But your head can flop forward and do damage to your neck during a very heavy accident. And maybe that's part of what the airbag is supposed to help. Okay.
You with a comment? Right.
Who is that with a further comment?
82NBC.
Mr. NBC, I'll start off with your name and then your comment.
Hi, this is Bob K, Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. Two comments. One very quick. I was also in an accident where I was sitting on the passenger's front seat. And we pulled into an intersection in Manhattan, broadsided right on my door, and I didn't see anything, but the driver informed me that, yes, there was an airbag. And the second comment is to Paul, WS2N's comment, when he talked about the, you should have the seats all over the back when you're driving. Unfortunately, that contradicts a change in my driving habits and my father's before me, where we used to have our seats all the way back, and we had back problems, and we pulled the seats up, and even though I'm fairly tall, I pulled the seat up pretty far, and it's much better for my back, so now I have a conflict.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Y2H with a comment.
Yeah, Bob, that is a conflict. 6-1, half a dozen the other. Lou, NY2H, go ahead.
Actually, I have two comments. First comment is to your friend that doesn't want to put his seatbelt on because he doesn't want to get trapped in his car in case it catches fire. So why doesn't he just carry around a box cutter or a pair of scissors, sharp scissors, and use his seatbelt, and if there's an emergency, he can still extricate himself. Second thing I want to say is in the insurance classes now that you can take every 3 years to get a better insurance rate or what have you, you know, they used to teach the 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock steering wheel position for your hands. Now they're teaching the 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock position because of the airbag deployment in the steering wheel, that if your hands are at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, you'll probably break your arms.
2BZ. Yes, I've gone to some of these defensive driving classes, and I've heard that exact same information. Bravo Zulu, go ahead.
That whole thing that we all learned in driver's ed in the 60s, 70s, or whatever, totally disqualified in terms of where you should keep your hands. But one thing, when I regained consciousness, I had the presence of mind. I remember me feeling my clothes to see if anything was wet, as in terms of blood, because I knew this was bad, but I didn't know if I was bleeding, so I started patting my shirt and my pants, and thankfully everything was dry.
Yeah, the amount of deceleration you have during an accident is sometimes amazing. I was fully strapped in with a fairly minor fender bender where somebody had cut me off and I struck their vehicle. And my glasses, which were pretty tight and wrapped around the back of my ears, ended up on the floor. It got ripped off my head. It gave me a pretty strong idea as to what kind of deceleration I had experienced. Anyway, further comments on airbags and things like this and automobile accidents, K2RIW will be listening.
KC2SHO, how about one more?
You've got it, John.
Okay, I remember years ago seeing some videos of guys, and these are probably, again, the older airbag systems. I don't know if the new ones would do this. Some guys goofing around in things like junkyards and automotive shops, and they would do funny things with airbags. And if you watch some of these videos, you can get a really clear picture of how much power there is in one of those airbags. And one I remember in particular, a guy puts the airbag on the floor. And this must be one of those two-wire systems because his buddy just connects it to a battery while he's sitting on top of it, and it shoots him, I don't know, 5 or 6 feet up in the air or something like that. And he didn't look like a small guy by any means. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
M2EL comment.
So, John, you're telling me he was foolish enough to sit directly on top of the airbag when it's sitting on the floor. Was there a sheet of material between him and that airbag? Back to you, John.
I've slept a lot of evenings since the last time I saw that video. He may have had something there, but it wasn't much. You know, it was a tire or a... Yeah, it's hard to remember, but... I remember thinking, you know, that could break your back. You could do some real damage to yourself with a stunt like that.
That G-force can certainly damage your back, and if your body is directly sitting on that airbag that's about to explode, the male organs in that area could easily be damaged. Boy, that sounds like a funny thing to do. N2EO, go ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I had a similar experience. I had taken medicine, my Tourette syndrome, and I left the house to go to Radio Shack. And I hadn't eaten anything. And it was a very hot day, maybe July or August, don't remember. Coming out of the parking lot, I must have blacked out for a second. Because I remember turning onto the road. And the next thing I knew, I barreled into the back of a lady's car. No damage to my car. Only thing I did to her car, the bumper had a piece of black rubber across the bumper. So I got out, I apologized to her. There's a place down the street. I told the Larry's Auto Collision, let's go there now, I'll pay for the rubber. Instead, she lays down in the road and calls for an ambulance and she's trying to sue me, but she couldn't. Had a lawyer that's a friend of Barry's, recently passed away, took the case for free. And what he did was kept postponing court. And the lady gave up after about a year because she had a contingency lawyer.
You didn't say, Rich, did your airbag deploy?
Oh, oddly enough, it didn't. And by the way, the brakes were bad on my car. Because when I came to and saw myself going into her car, I hit the brake immediately. It wasn't good enough. I took the car to a mechanic, right, formerly trusted, cut the rotors down, and it was still bad. Anyway, what I did, I found out that the, looking at the brake fluid, rust inside. So, my father was still alive. He helped me bleed the brakes. I put new brake fluid in, and of course, you would pump the pedal to get the air out, and I close the valve one at a time, and that solved the problem.
Understand, Rich. Okay, Freddy asked us quite a question. We're going to move on to the next person. Bob, to K2MHL. Sorry to keep you waiting this long. Go right ahead, Bob. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I think that my questions really belong with Dr. Roy tonight, and I should write it up for him. I would like him to go through the use of thorium as a nuclear fuel and also molten salt reactors. And one more thing on your last comments about the cars and airbags and things. It is rather silly. Airbags and seat belts are all taking care of it after the accident. What we need is things to happen before the accident, like automatic brakes and steering. That's all I have for now. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, they are moving in the direction of artificial intelligence being added to our automobiles, where they can steer themselves and they can sense that something is an obstacle in front of the vehicle and apply the brakes even faster than the human reaction time. So in that respect, they're going to become safer. I think, Bravo Zulu, I think he wanted to ask a question. Rich, go right ahead.
Hey, I saw a very interesting video on YouTube where this ham radio operator was saying that we're all fooling ourselves in terms of bringing down the SWR on our radios, and what he had was a external SWR watt meter, which showed that even though, and he kept on saying, the antenna tuner in the radio or the antenna tuner that he introduced at the radio or MFJ tuner, they're making the radio happy. That was the way he put it. It's making the radio happy. It's not tuning the antenna. And he was showing where both the MFJ antenna tuner and his rig showed very little reflected power, but his external watt meter, SWR watt meter, was showing a tremendous amount of reflected power. Does he have that right?
W2 Bravo Zulu, K2RW. Yes, he does have that right. If you're using, say, a 50-ohm transmission line, and if the antenna does not present a load impedance of a 50-ohm resistor, then a calculatable amount of power will be reflected from the antenna. So the antenna being a mismatch to the transmission line creates a predictable amount of reflected power. When that power comes back to your transmitter, it can make your final stage of your transmitter very unhappy. By putting an antenna tuner in there, that reflected power no longer gets back to the transmitter. When you're adjusting the antenna tuner and the impedance matching between the transmitter and that crazy antenna plus feed line, you think you're doing an impedance match. That's true. Simultaneously, you don't realize what you're doing is you're taking the reflected power coming back down the transmission line from the mismatch antenna, re-reflecting it forward with the power now being generated in phase from the transmitter. So the power is now bouncing back and forth in the transmission line, but you do get a better impedance match, you do get a higher amount of power radiated by the antenna,
the antenna tuner does not waste the reflected power. It reflects it forward. So if you're putting your bird wattmeter after the antenna tuner on the antenna side, on the feed line side, you will see the predictable amount of reflected power to forward power ratio that represents that particular standing wave ratio. If, for instance, your standing wave ratio was as high as 5.8 to 1, 50% of your power would be reflected. So he's telling the truth. At first you would think the antenna tuner is giving you no benefit. It's giving you a lot of benefit once you understand what's going on. Does that make a little more sense? W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
He was saying the opposite. He was saying if you get lulled into a false sense of good antenna matching with both the tuner and your rig that are saying that your SWR is low and you have very little reflected power. But on an external SWR wattmeter, he was showing right there how that's not true, how that external wattmeter and SWR meter was showing a tremendous amount of reflected power.
He's telling you the truth. If the antenna tuner was the remote type, if it was mounted right at the antenna, then it would be stopping the reflected power right at the source. Because the antenna tuner is in the shack, the feed line is still mismatched to the antenna. There still has to be a certain reflected power ratio at the antenna. That power has to travel back down the transmission line until it hits the output connector of the antenna tuner. So, is it lulling you into a false alarm, so to speak? Not true. The antenna tuner is giving you benefit. It doesn't correct the standing wave ratio of the antenna. You've got to correct it at the source. It makes the antenna plus your feed line a livable situation for that transmitter. Maybe your transmitter cannot tolerate more than a 1.8 to 1, and your antenna happens to be a 3 to 1. The antenna tuner will correct that. The antennas you've got in your cell phone radio has to cover a whole lot of frequencies. No antenna can do that. Every cell phone you own, the very first component connected to that antenna is an antenna tuner inside of your cell phone. That's how that antenna can work on all those crazy frequencies. Bravo Zulu, K2RIW, go ahead.
So his term of making the radio happy is what you're saying is accomplished by the antenna tuner. However, to really know what's going on, you need an external SWR wattmeter. Is that correct?
Actually, I don't think I can tell.
There's a yes and a no to that one. The antenna tuner corrects the situation from the transmitter's point of view. It doesn't correct the fact that your antenna is still mismatched to that transmission line. If you want to stop power being reflected back and forth in your transmission line and experiencing the extra loss of the transmission line because of the multiple reflections, then you've got to fix the antenna, so to speak. But the antenna tuner is still giving you a benefit. It is not wasting that reflected power. There's a ridiculous number of guys transmitting all this old wives' tale on 20 meters telling everybody that antenna tuner doesn't do you any good. It takes all the reflected power and throws it away. Absolutely not. A well-designed antenna tuner runs ice cold. A Bravo Zulu, does that make some sense? K2LIW?
So, what it does is when, again, his term, making the radio happy, it allows you to operate. But he said in some circumstances, you could see a low SWR and low reflected power. Nobody's going to hear you.
Absolutely not true. Some antenna tuners have a Viswire detecting circuit built in. On some antenna tuners, you can find out what is the real Viswire of your antenna, that it is correcting from the transmitter's point of view. But still, as long as you don't have a sky-high transmission line in insertion loss, if your transmitter can put out 100 watts, and if you've got a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio on your antenna, which means half of all the power is reflected at a 5.8-to-1, and if you've got a reasonably low loss transmission line, and you're using an antenna tuner, of that 100 watts you're generating, you're probably still going to radiate 85 watts of it. They're going to hear you. Bravo Zulu,
IW.
Okay, so would you make this statement? I understand exactly now what's going on. Thank you, Dick. Would you make this statement that if you have an SWR watt meter, you know, in your rig, or an antenna tuner on your rig or next to your rig, that an external watt meter, SWR watt meter, is not necessary because you sort of know what's going on?
Some antenna tuners contain an internal standing wave ratio circuit, so you can find out how bad the antenna is and how good it's working in order to correct it. I mean, if you had a really Cadillac antenna tuner, you would be able to flip the switches so that it told you the output circuit standing wave ratio. That's what the antenna and feed line are really doing. And you could flip it to the input circuit and find out what is the standing wave ratio the transmitter is seeing. So if you had a Cadillac antenna tuner, you would be able to find out what is the input visual and the output visual. As long as you haven't run out of range on the tuning and loading control of your antenna tuner, you should be able to make the input visual perfect, no matter how high the output visual is, within reason. The antenna tuner is giving you benefit, but is it matching the antenna to the transmission line? Of course not. It is matching your transmitter to that radiating circuit and keeping the transmitter happy and allowing you, in most cases, to still radiate 85% of the power you're generating. And any of that power that's lost, it's lost in the transmission line because power is bouncing back and forth in that transmission line. Bravo Zulu, K2LIW.
K2UPS.
I guess the biggest benefit is it's allowing the radio to work, correct?
That's one of many benefits. Rich first, Rich number one, and Rich number two in that order, UPS. N2EO, briefly go ahead there, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Rich, he said, you never put a external watt meter on the output side of the cable. You always put the watt meter on an external antenna tuner between the radio and the input side to the tuner. That's the way it's always done, because you want to null out the SWR, the antenna tuner is basically a transformer, matching the line to the radio. Now, like Dick said, it doesn't throw the power away. You'll get power in your feed line that's in phase, so it'll radiate. As far as high loss, coax. I've always run on the antenna tuner open wireline. A lot of people think open wireline radiates. It does not. Inside, one side and the other side of 180 degrees out of phase. In other words, when one side is pushing, the other side is pulling. So the net result is zero radiation in the shack. I've used open wireline for years, and I'm using it now. The best thing, because you can think you'll tell them, open wireline has virtually no loss, even ridiculously high SWR. But you always put the watt meter and SWR watt meter between the output of the radio and the input of the tuner. Back to net, K2RIW and 2EO.
I pretty much agree with that. By putting the bird watt meter on the input side of the antenna tuner, it allows you to properly adjust the antenna tuner. You, as a scientist, could then decide to put the bird watt meter on the output side, because as you want to know academically how bad is the standing wave ratio of that antenna. Another thing that I agree with is that open wire line in many cases has such an extremely low insertion loss that in that case, I can tolerate an extremely high standing wave ratio. As long as your antenna tuner doesn't run out of range, the whole system can be a 98% efficient system with a ridiculously high standing wave ratio. K2UPS, I bet you you've lived with some interesting standing wave ratios over your days, Rich. K2UPS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS mobile. How are you going to say the name from that Rich? That many guys get confused when they have a few pieces of equipment, a radio, a separate antenna tuner, and a separate SWR stroke one gear, and they put the one gear after the antenna tuner. And that's not what belongs between it, because the output of the antenna tuner that's doing its job is not going to be 50 ohms. It's going to be less than 50 ohms or more than 50 ohms. And most likely, that SWR and that one gear was originally calibrated for 50 ohms. Now, it'll give you a relative reading. You'll see changes, but it certainly won't be accurate. So you want to measure it between the tuner and the radio, not after the tuner.
K2UPS just expressed an opinion that's a very widely held opinion. Even the doctor is in expressed that opinion. I'm pretty sure it's inaccurate. The transmission line itself has a center conductor and outer conductor diameter ratio that is a 50 ohm circuit. That standing wave ratio meter is telling you the truth. It's telling you how much forward power there is and how much reverse power there is on that 50 ohm cable. When you read the instructions for your Berg wattmeter, it does not tell you you cannot use it in a circuit that doesn't have a perfect match. Every antenna system that doesn't have a perfect match, the input impedance to the transmission line will appear to be not 50 ohms. Does that mean you can never use the antenna you can never use the Berg wattmeter? Of course you can. Now, you're going to get a confusing reading if you have a standing wave ratio that's quite high and the antenna tuner that's properly set and you have a transmitter that you know is putting out 100 watts. You might see 150 watts forward and 75 watts coming back. That is telling you the truth. How can the forward power be greater than what the transmitter is generating? It's because of the resonance effect. The fact that power is bouncing back and forth in that transmission line, all the reflected power is being added to the forward power in phase when the antenna tuner is properly tuned. That forward power can be higher than what the transmitter is generating. And that is telling you a kind of truth. There are people who call that reactive power, saying it's not real. Oh, really? I can put a directional coupler on it. I can calibrate my directional coupler so that I can recognize 150 watts. I can take that directional couple sampled power, I can light a light bulb with it. That is real power. You can have greater power forward than the transmitter is generating. It's telling you a kind of truth. A Berg wattmeter can be used in a circuit that has a high VISWA. If it can't be used in any high VISWA circuit, then why in the world would they give you these charts telling you this forward power and this reverse power ratio represents this particular standing wave ratio? A Berg wattmeter can be used in any circuit that has a 50 ohm transmission line. And if you know how to properly calibrate it and offset the numbers, you could even use it in a 75 ohm transmission line. But I won't go there right now. So there's a lot of misconcept on that particular one, Rich. K2UPS, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead and defend yourself on that one, Rich. Maybe Rich is in a dropout area right now. That's too bad. It's going to be kind of frustrating for him when I did, and he doesn't have a chance to defend himself on that one. So a Berg wattmeter can be used in any 50-ohm circuit. It is telling you a kind of truth. You have to be careful how you interpret that truth. There are people who say, hey, this is phony. How come I'm reading 135 watts forward and my transmitter only puts out 100 watts? In that particular circuit, with that antenna tuner, and that particular high VISWR antenna, that is really the forward power. You're not radiating 135 watts. You may be radiating 90 watts of it, and the rest is being reflected and it's bouncing back and forth. But the forward power and reverse power, the third route meter does tell you a kind of truth. Okay, we've gone quite a bit beyond the usual amount of time we spend on the question and answer period. If you've got some further questions, we'll pick them up next week. We're way beyond the circuit time when we should be going over to Roy. Dr. Roy, AC2GS, with this beautiful puzzle this week. K2RW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. And I want to mention to Bob, WA2MHL, he wanted to know more about the thorium reactors and molten salt reactors. I actually did a whole presentation of that. If you're interested, you can go to amateurradio.tv and search for the March 17th, 2018 edition of the Technical Net and take a listen to it. If that's not enough, then feel free to email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com, and I'll do another presentation. The subject really hasn't, unfortunately, changed much in the last year or so. It's a fascinating field of research that was kind of abandoned decades ago, unfortunately, in favor of plutonium-based nuclear reactors. Anyway, as always, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is at roy.ac2gs.com. I do have a mailbag question for you tonight, Dick, as I mentioned before, so would you like to have it now?
Now's a good time. Fire away.
Okay, a TechNet listener, I don't think he's a ham because he doesn't give his call sign. Was interested last week when he was listening to the TechNet. There was some lightning, there was some thunder, and it got him thinking about the subject of lightning and thunder. And since you bring electromagnetic fields to life in your discussions, he wanted to know your view of not necessarily just the phenomena of lightning, but what causes the phenomena of thunder after it. He has some pet theories. He thinks that some component of the sound wave is produced by the decay of the plasma, the high-pressure field, after the lightning abates. But he would like to have a little your opinion of what's going on as far as lightning and especially thunder.
Yeah, lightning is an extremely interesting subject. It's only partially understood. There are times when a cloud above you, part of a thunderstorm, might be at 50 million volts, let's say, and air breaks down at 50,000 volts per centimeter, I think it is, or is it per inch, I'm not sure which, and that cloud might be at 5,000 feet, and can lightning go across that 5,000 foot distance between the cloud and ground? Absolutely not. Doesn't have anywhere near enough voltage to do it. On average, the lightning bolt has enough voltage to jump approximately 120 feet on average. So if you look at a lightning bolt, take a picture of it, you'll see it's got a whole lot of zigzags. And each of the little individual zigs and zags are on average 120 feet long. A cloud is charged, a cosmic ray comes along, ionizes a path, the lightning will jump the first 120 feet and sit there and wait until, in the next couple of microseconds, wait until the next cosmic ray comes along at some other crazy direction going through that tip of the 120 foot ionization and then make the next jump. And so each of those individual zigs and zags represent places where a cosmic ray went during that lightning event. A typical lightning bolt, typical is around 11,000 volts, 11,000 amperes. There are super lightning bolts in the Pacific Ocean sometimes that hit numbers like 150,000 amperes. Huge amount of current. Let me drop. And that lightning bolt, when it finally zigs and zags and makes the complete path between cloud and ground, and your 11,000 or 50,000 amperes flows, it has ionized the air. That 50,000 amperes flowing makes a tremendous temperature. An average lightning bolt hits numbers like 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, five times hotter than the surface of the sun during the 20 microseconds of that event. It makes an extremely high temperature. What does that high temperature do? Let me give you a couple examples of this.
took a nuclear bomb and blasted it off into the vacuum of space, a tremendous amount of high-speed Compton electrons would come running out of there, a whole lot of individual rays. You would get a lot of nuclear event rays flying out of that bomb. You would not get a blast. The shockwave blast you get from a nuclear bomb is because it has heated up the local air. Air, when it's heated, will expand by a predictable amount, and it can create some extremely high pressure waves, and you'd be amazed how much mass air has. Take your nearest physics savvy human being that you know and ask him this very simple question. I have in front of me 1 cubic meter of the air that's in this room, that's with us right now. I got this very strong steel box that's 1 cubic meter. What's the weight of the air that's in that box? The average person will say, oh, it's a couple of milligrams. He's wrong by 1,000,000 to 1. Air has a mass of 2.7 pounds, 1.2 kilograms per cubic meter. Air is heavy stuff. If you don't believe it, start off with some amount of volume you know about. In theory, you could start off with a 1 cubic meter, very strong steel box, put it on a scale, weigh it, then put a vacuum pump on there, suck the air out, and weigh it again. You'll see 1.2 kilograms of difference, 2.7 pounds. Air is heavy stuff. Timothy McVeigh exploded a bomb at the Mura building in Oklahoma City. None of that bomb struck the building. That bomb of his created a shockwave in air. The air striking the building collapsed most of that building and killed 168 people. The shockwave in air did that. Air has got, when it comes to a high temperature event like his bomb going off, the air expanding around that event created a shockwave that can be very destructive. The most destructive bomb the United States has is a so-called fuel air bomb. A bunker buster, I think it's sometimes called. Let me drop.
FYU emergency traffic.
Go ahead with your emergency traffic.
Very heavy thunderstorms, very strong lightning coming across the Brooklyn-Queens border eastward at this time. Anybody with high antennas, take note.
Okay, thank you, George. So the majority of the thunder that you hear is the 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit of that lightning bolt. That lightning bolt has got all kinds of zigs and zags. Each of one of those zigs and zags, roughly 120 feet long on average, is creating a shockwave spreading out from that particular zig and zag. Because that zigs and zags have different distances from you and different orientations, not all of that sound hits you at once. The thunder cloud that you hear, the thunder bolt that you hear, has got a very long sound to it because portions of it are more than a mile away from you. Each mile takes 5 seconds for the sound to spread through that mile. So the majority of the sound you hear from a thunder, from a lightning bolt, is the heating of the air creating the expansion that creates the shockwave that gives you that sound. And as I said before, air expanding when you heat it violently, like it was a nuclear device, or with the plasma of a lightning bolt, creates a tremendous amount of expanding shockwave. The majority of the sound you hear is the expansion. Does the air then pop back in again and give you a second boom? Possibly so, but I don't think anywhere is as loud as that first expansion. And the cooling off of the air in that vicinity doesn't happen instantaneously. That air that you just heated with that 50,000 degree Fahrenheit plasma of the 11,000 ampere lightning bolt, that air gets heated, expands violently, very rapidly. It slowly cools off over the next couple of seconds and comes back down. You don't hear a second thunderclap because of the air coming back down. The shockwave of the original event of the air expanding is the majority of what you're hearing. That's what I believe is going on, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment, and to wheel.
Yes, Richie, comment away.
Okay. You know, I had lightning in Whitestone, and the thunderclap was exactly coincided with the lightning bolt. What I found out the next morning, I have a VHF UHF antenna, no fiberglass radome, with blown bits. Part of it wound up a couple of houses down in the neighbor's tree. It was the highest thing in the area, so that's why I got hit, boy.
And that 11,000 ampere strike that hit your radome of your antenna expanded the air that's inside, and that air damaged your radome, as a guess on my part. So when you heat air, it can expand with tremendous amount of force, and that shock wave is very destructive, like what happened at the Mura building and what happens with a fuel-air bomb. So the majority of that lightning bolt is a rapidly expanding chunk of air heated to 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit in roughly 20 microseconds. And by the way, a lightning bolt is never one single strike. There's usually 3, 4, or 5 individual strikes in there, a few microseconds apart on each one of those. Whenever you see, if you go to the, what's the name of that company? Microphaser. Microphaser makes lightning arresters. They also give you they will sell you a book that gives you a lot of information about lightning. So if you go to the Microphaser company and buy their lightning reference book, you'll get some very interesting reading. AC2GS, KQLIW, go ahead, Roy.
Dick, you mean polyphase?
Polyphaser is exactly. Thank you for correcting me. You got it, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Dick. Well, one thing that the people kind of learn when they're little kids is if you count the difference between the flash of lightning and the sound of thunder, count the number of seconds, that's approximately how many miles away the lightning struck, because light travels much faster than sound waves do. And you can actually simulate in a relatively safe environment the noise made by arcing electricity in these little Tesla coils. On Amazon, they have them from China. They cost about $50-$60. They actually have a sound input where you can play music. It's very tinny, but you can play music by the arcing of the Tesla coil. And there's a bunch of guys who make enormous Tesla coils who will put on concerts based upon Tesla coils. They tend to give you tinny sounds. They make halfway decent tweeters, terrible whoopers. But you can see it in action in that environment in a much safer way than lightning and thunder.
Comment.
Now, sound, by the way, spreads at around 1,100 or 1,090 feet per second. So you see the flash of lightning, and you count the number of seconds. Divide by 5. That equals the number of miles. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, Wesley had something to say?
Yeah, I have a problem with both of your explanations. So I can accept 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 times hotter than the surface of the sun, superheated air coils, produce resonating tube, or the partial vacuum surrounding the lighting path. Now, here's the problem. You look at the sun in vacuum. Let me jump. So we have a nearby air rapidly expands and contracts. Everything is fine. Then you're looking at the vector of the sound travel, and you're looking at that pipe or that cone that is surrounding the lightning. The sound never comes there because it's a vacuum. It's a partial vacuum. So the guy that is directly below or is in the vicinity of the striking, he's not going to be able to count 5, 1, or whatever. The sound will not come there. Do you agree with that? And do it here.
Many ham radio operators have had a direct strike on their radio tower in that particular circumstance, like what Rich experienced. The distance between the time between the flash and what you hear is instantaneous. The majority of the sound from the expanding shockwave, and by the way, that lightning bolt takes place in a couple of microseconds. Sound is much, much slower than that. So almost all of the sound coming off of the shaft of the
plasma wave of the lightning bolt itself, 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, happens at right angles. There's a tube of expanding air, a cylinder of expanding air around each zig and zag of that lightning bolt. And the majority of the sound propagates broadside at right angles. That doesn't mean there is no sound off the end. It's just not as loud off the end. It's still plenty loud when you're near it. The majority of the sound is broadside. And that sound is expanding air. I didn't say it creates a vacuum afterwards. I said the air expanded because it has been heated, gives you a shock wave that expands out. The air slowly over the next, let me pick a number, half a second cools off, and you do get some contraction and partial vacuum and air coming back slowly. That's not where the sound is coming from. The sound is coming from the microsecond event of the air being very suddenly heated to 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit and radiating a sound wave primarily broadside to that zig and that zag. That's what I believe is happening. AC2GS, K2LIW.
The problem that I have is not that you had that, that it is or it is not a vacuum. That in fact it is a vacuum. It's a partial vacuum. It is different in pressure in the area surrounding the lightning cloud and outside of it. So there is a different properties for the sound wave to travel in this partial vacuum. And that was my point, Dr. Roy.
When Timothy McVeigh exploded his bomb and made a shock wave that spread through air and collapsed most of the Mura building and killed 168 building people, do you believe it was the positive pressure of that shock wave that destroyed the building, or do you think it was the partial vacuum that did that? Over to you, Wes.
It is a transfer of pressure from point A to point B. So it is a transformation of pressure points from point A to point B that is causing the shockwave. Do you agree with that?
The positive pressure of that shockwave is what destroys that building. When that bomb went off, he had walked down the street, made a right-hand turn, was walking down another street. The remainder of that shockwave came down that street and plastered him up against this building that he was near. And he supposedly said, "What the hell was that?" The forward edge of that shockwave is what destroys that building. The partial vacuum that followed afterwards was a secondary minor event, in my opinion.
Oh, well, I have a problem with that, ladies and gentlemen. If you put your finger into your mouth and you pushing with your mouth and then you sucking with your mouth, the force is exactly the same. Enter exia.
So you're telling me the vacuum created by you're telling me the vacuum created by his bomb is what collapsed that building, is what you're trying to tell me?
Absolutely not. The positive pressure is what collapsed it. What I'm saying is that when you have a chamber, the chamber is limited by the walls of the chamber, that's your mouth. Now, the vector of pushing and vector of pulling or vector of sucking is exactly the same. So when you have a thunderstorm and then you have a lightning that is surrounded by partial vacuum, you created those walls of the chamber. That's what it's here.
You've got it right.
Okay, Dick, thank you. This might degenerate into semantics once again, but the problem I have is this is an open air, so there's no boundary layer, so there's not much really of negative pressure going on. Well, what I see is happening is as the gas is ionized and reaches the high temperature, boils low, have you, the pressure goes sky high. The density of the air lessens, but the pressure remains greater than atmospheric pressure, which is the force that expands it. Eventually, as it cools down, it equilibrates to the pressure of the surrounding atmosphere, and as it cools down any farther, the pressure of the outside atmosphere will rush back in. So you're never going to see a vacuum or even a significant vacuum.